How do you know you're up to date? When you follow EMS World, you answer that question with confidence. Because when we say EMS World, we mean the whole world of EMS. The remaining question for you is, how will you stay up to date? In print, online, at EMS World Expo, the world's largest EMS dedicated conference, and now in a podcast.
Don't forget that the best resource you have available to you to make any type of improvement, process improvement, or a safety improvement, or a patient care improvement, it's those field employees that are your best resource.
We learned early in school that a good medic learns to adapt and overcome in different situations. That's exactly what our medics are doing, adapting their approach to patient care to overcome the years of unsafe practices while providing excellent patient care. This is Hillary Gates, Senior Editorial and Program Director with EMS World. Today, I'm talking with Kelly Deal. Kelly, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Hillary. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Can you introduce yourself for everyone, please?
Yes, I'm Kelly Deal. Last name is D-E-A-L, like Let's Make a Deal. I'm the director of Ulaga Tallala EMS out of Ulaga, Oklahoma.
I'm glad I don't have to pronounce that, but I know that you guys call yourselves OTEMS, O-T-E-M-S. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, good. I'll use that from now on. In the EMS World profile that we did for our September issue, we talked about how OTEMS recently purchased new Type 2 or van-style ambulances, and this was motivated mostly due to the interest that you all have in the safety for your patients and your providers. Providers can access their equipment and treat the patient staying belted during transport. Kelly, you mentioned there was sort of an unintended effect on your recruitment and that OTEMS seemed to get more people applying, or at least people applying who were interested in working for an agency who had these type of ambulances. Can you tell me more about that?
As you stated, it was an unexpected benefit of the new units. They've gotten a lot of press locally and created a lot of interest, not just from the field employees, but also from other ambulance services throughout the state and the region, just because of the change, a significant change in design. As time went on, and we've had them in service for the last almost 3 months, we have seen an increase in our applications. You know, one of the typical questions is, you know, what attracted you to OTEMS? I mean, we're a small rural service with a low call volume. And what we're seeing is we have several potential employees who have come in who have a history of working in large systems, high call volume, high performance systems, typically in a Type 1 truck. And just as I have thought throughout my 40 plus years in EMS, all those days, I wondered if today would be the day that my head's going to go into that bulkhead. By eliminating that, it clearly becomes something that attracts people that have probably a little more experience in the business, may or may not have had close calls, or may or may not be in a situation where their safety is a little more important to them. We see a lot of single parents that have come in that said, you know, I really have to be aware of the hazards that exist in my career. You are a service that provides us an alternative in one of the most dangerous arenas that EMS functions, and that's during emergency response and driving.
It sounds like this is something that actually made you pretty happy and made you proud to be the director. Can you talk more about the first couple times you might have heard this, or tell a story about conversations you've had with these applicants, and then maybe how you brought that back to your own folks and the current employees and chatted with them about it?
We have a two-interview process on hiring new employees. The first interview is conducted by a group of our field employees. They then make recommendations to the management team, and then we have a secondary interview with them, which is when the decision is made whether to hire or not. The first employee or the first candidate that came in that voiced this interest in the increased focus on safety was a single mother of two toddlers. She had worked in a high call volume, high performance system, and she almost said exactly what I had stated earlier, in that, you know, in the back of a box, you spend most of your time on your knees, unrestrained. You don't necessarily have to have a crash. You can have a hard stop, and you're going to slide right down that floor right into the bulkhead. She's made the comment, there were so many times, so many close calls, that if I have the opportunity to provide for my family in a safer environment, why would I not want to pursue that?
That's pretty impressive. And are you taking them to see the ambulances during the interview process? Are you actually walking them through the units themselves or allowing them to sit in them? And if so, what's that like?
The tour portion typically happens during the second interview. So when I'm sitting down one-on-one or there's two of us on the interview process from a management standpoint with an employee, we ask them not to make a decision until they have taken a look at our equipment, make sure that they're comfortable with it, and that they understand the reasons for the concept change. Sometimes they're aware of it because they've seen the news, they've seen reports about the new trucks, but most of the time, if they haven't heard of it, their first thought is that there's no way I can work in here. And so we have them get up, sit into the captain's chair that's forward facing, have them put on their 3-point safety harness, and ask them to reach the ventilator, the monitor, the IV pump, adjustments on the auto pulse, just a number of things that we have them reach. And almost immediately they realize it's very functional, it's very practical, and it is very safe. About the only skill that would require relocation to the head of the patient, as in the traditional captain's chair, would be an intubation or an advanced airway management other than intubation. So really, we're talking about less than 5% of our transports would require, actually much less than that, would require taking off the belt and relocating. As I said, we have two captain's chairs, one's forward-facing and then one's at the traditional location of the head of the patient.
So you've been in EMS a long time. You referenced your own experience in the back of the unit and not being restrained. What does that do for you as a leader of an agency like this? And what does it say about how you are processing what these applicants are saying to you? Because I imagine that as this was an unintended effect of the ambulance redesign, you hadn't really pursued this, but it's now perhaps becoming one thing that attracts people to your agency. What does that say about the state that we're in and what EMS values right now, and especially what employees like the single mother of two that you mentioned, what they value?
From a leader standpoint, I had been in this position a little less than a year when we had a rollover accident with our one of our older Type 1s. A large hay bale came off of a truck in front of our ambulance who was coming around a corner on a highway. And basically two cars swerved, leaving the ambulance no option other than to hit the hay bale. It took out his steering. He went across three lanes of traffic, hit a guardrail, pirouetted one time around, and then went end over end down an embankment. That ended the career of both the paramedic and the EMT that were in that ambulance. From that point on, it was always our desire that if we could get into the position that we could build our own fleet or rebuild a fleet with new ambulances, because traditionally with the limited budgeting, we had used ambulances. So when we had the opportunity to build new units, we wanted to make sure that we were doing everything possible to protect the patient, as well as the paramedic and the EMT in all functions, not just while driving the ambulance, but also at the scene. We went with a full loading automatic cot, so there's very minimal lifting that's required. Just trying to look at every component that we could look at to help limit that risk and increase the safety levels.
So, Kelly, tell me more about the type of reaction you got from your own employees, as well as some of the reaction that you got on social media, because we all know EMS providers like to comment on things on social media, and they seem to do that a lot with your page. You kind of turn them around. Can you talk about the interactions you had with folks on social media regarding this innovation?
Ryan Setscorn, at the time, was our assistant director. He's since moved on, but he was, other than given some direction, this was his baby. He had a clear understanding from myself and our team on what direction we wanted to go from a safety standpoint. And so he took it and ran with it. Once we started the design process, of course, our employees were very skeptical. We took a few employees on a couple of road trips, let them see the units, explain the design features, the safety features, and the thought process behind them. And they were quickly sold on the idea. but yet a little skeptical until the ambulances actually arrived. Once they arrived, the consensus was pretty quick in the conversations that I've had. Every employee is very comfortable, very appreciative, has a full understanding of the safety approach, has nothing but good things to say about those ambulances from everything I've heard. We've had just the negative comments we've seen have not been internally. They've been externally, as you said, on social media. I think how Ryan approached that, he took each criticism as a challenge as to how he can prove to them that this concept will work. It's not as restrictive as it may appear. One example is that they said, well, that's great if you're a small statured person working in that environment, but what if you're a large person? So Ryan went out and found literally a 6'10" paramedic, had him get in the back and asked him to do multiple skills and show that he could reach, and took a video and released that on our social media. It clearly showed that size is not going to be a limiting factor while trying to function in full paramedic capacity in the back of the units.
That's pretty great. Another thing that your paramedics talked to me about when I was interviewing them for the article was that they also didn't realize how important it was for the patient to physically be able to see them the entire time in the back as they were transporting. One of your paramedics said that a patient remarked, oh, you're going to sit back here with me? Usually I don't see the paramedic during transport. And the patient, you know, kind of was thinking that the provider was leaving the back of the unit and getting in the cab, when in reality they were sitting in the captain's chair. And then further on that is that the patient and the provider are now interacting more fully, not only about what's going on medically, but socially and just personally. Can you talk about what your providers have been saying about that?
We don't have the regular patient transports like a high call volume system would, but we have a few. And the ones that we transport on a regular basis have been so pleased, not just with the closeness and, for lack of a better word, the intimacy because of the closeness that is created between the caregiver and the patient. But, you know, they've also been very pleased with the ride. The transient versus an F-450, the ride is not comparable whatsoever. We give an amazingly smooth ride. So overall, from a patient standpoint, it's been a huge success because they're more comfortable. They feel more at ease because of that communication and that relationship that's really enhanced during our longer transport times than what a metropolitan service would see. And we really practice and work very hard at customer service here, in addition to what we think is optimal patient care. But our motto is that a good paramedic knows when it's more important to hold the patient's hand than it is to start an IV. So that's kind of the approach we want to take to not just patient care, but customer service, and really pushing the kindness and compassion that is what brings most people into the business to begin with.
Terrific. We all know that one of the biggest issues in EMS right now is recruitment and retention. And here you are, the leader of a small agency in Oklahoma with some great success with a recent innovation in your own service. What would you say to other folks in your position, other leaders, officers, chiefs, who are in the position to hire people and who are looking for ways to retain their employees and make sure that they're satisfied? What's some advice you might give to those people?
Be open-minded to changes. I've spent most of my career in a type 1. A big box is what I was comfortable in. Quite frankly, changing to a type 2 was very difficult for me. And strangely enough, it didn't have much to do with the space inside the box, but it had more to do with the ability to transport, you know, two supine patients. And I can go back to the 80s when it wasn't unusual that you hung patients from the ceiling and you can transport up to four patients that were supine. So things have really changed from a safety concept. And I had a hard time letting myself go, especially in the rural arena, from the ability to transport two patients in one ambulance. When I look at the risk versus benefit, or the cost and the benefit that we received, there wasn't an argument. So please be open to not just these changes that are happening now, but the future changes that are going to come around that are going to make the ambulance transportation industry much safer than what we've even done or tried to do.
Great. Thank you. And is there anything that I didn't ask that you wanted to add?
To me, the most important part of the process, and Ryan did it very, very well, was to make sure that the employees were involved in every step of the way. It may have not been all employees, but all employees had an opportunity. So those who did participate were very vital to the process that we took. We took our time with the development, with the design. We did a lot of research. I say that Ryan did a majority of that work. And so I would say, don't forget that the best resource you have available to you to make any type of improvement or a process improvement or a safety improvement or a patient care improvement, it's those field employees that are your best resource. And with every move, we try to tap into that knowledge, frequently asking them how we can do things better and what we need to do differently. So we also put a big focus here on an employee committee that has just been redesigned. And so we're excited to see how that's going to play into our management approach to give the employees a little more voice, a little more responsibility, as well as ownership in some of the decisions that we make and the directions that we go.
Wonderful. Kudos to you, Kelly, and your organization for doing this. And kudos to OTEMS for really making patient and provider safety a priority in a pretty dangerous job.
We are blessed with a board of directors who are very involved and also understood the concept and also very well understood the benefits. You know, everybody's got that system in place, and ours just happened to work in this particular case very well.
Great. Great to talk to you, and look forward to hearing more about your innovation in the future. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you, Hillary. I had a blast. I appreciate it.
And here's our article read aloud from Senior Editor and Program Director Hillary Gates. She's reading her story called Selling Small, How an Oklahoma Service Moved to Type 2 Trucks. It's from September 2019's EMS World magazine.
When the leaders of Oklahoma's Uloga Tallala EMS, hereafter referred to as OTEMS, decided to order four transit-style Type 2 ambulances and a complete redesign of their previous box truck-style units, they knew getting employee buy-in might not be easy. After all, as one OTEMS paramedic put it, "We don't like to change." Said another, "I was definitely not on board in the beginning." So Ryan Setzkorn, who was OTEM's assistant director of EMS at the time, knew he needed to involve his team at each step in the process. He gathered their design ideas and weighed each one. He brought employees to the Osage Ambulance Facility in Missouri so they could give input. And he proved to them these smaller ambulances could keep them safe. EMS providers in the patient compartment would have all equipment at arm's reach while staying belted during transport. It was an emotional play for Setzkorn, who turned to the internet to find distressing coverage of ambulance crashes throughout the world. "I wanted them to get out of the mindset of, this can't happen to me," says Setzkorn. "I replayed the news clip of our own 2010 OTEMS crash, as well as other ambulance crash videos, to show them that this can happen anytime." While Setzkorn wasn't with OTEMS for the 2010 crash that retired two providers, he knew that had the paramedic in back been belted, things may have played out differently. The OTEMS ambulance was transporting a patient when EMT Austin Moore, who was driving, swerved to avoid hay bales in the road. This caused a rollover, and the ambulance pirouetted in an end-over-end crash so forceful it ripped the cot, with patient, from its antlers. The paramedic in the back, Todd Barron, said he tried to grab onto the bar on the ceiling during the crash, but he just couldn't hang on. OTEMS director Kelly Deal, who praises Setzkorn's passion, said he didn't need any convincing for this new venture. In more than 40 years as an EMS provider himself, Deal says he never stopped thinking, "Here I am, on my knees, unrestrained, providing patient care. Will today be the day I'm going to crash and hit the bulkhead?" 7 years on from Barron's and Moore's crash, OTEMS has four new ambulances of the Type 2 standard, paid for with $800,000 of bond money from the local taxpayers. OTEMS was thrilled to learn that instead of buying just two new Type 3 ambulances from Osage, it could afford four new units for the same price. Safety first. You can't accuse Setzkorn of not knowing the importance of safety. while working as a flight medic, he survived two helicopter crashes. After recovering from both with relatively minor physical injuries and being treated for PTSD, Sesgorn read the NTSB reports. He noticed that the NTSB praised the design of the interior of the helicopter's patient compartment, specifically that all of the equipment stayed in place, secured to the walls or floor. Here's a massive crashed machine that has enough integrity inside to keep the equipment from flying around the compartment, Sesgorn thought. The design stayed with him because he knew the same principles should apply to an ambulance. Then Sesgorn hit the jackpot when he saw a former peer, Chad Poor, then director of Kansas's Butler County EMS, post on Facebook that Butler County EMS had designed and ordered its own Type 2 units. The ideas were definitely stolen from Chad and Butler County EMS, says Sesgorn. I remember watching their Facebook videos and thinking, Chad, you just put into words a lot of what I've been thinking over the years. Sesgorn's proposal was a no-brainer for his boss. For us, it is employee safety first, patient safety second, Deal says. But we also do not want to hinder patient care in any way. Deal knew his employees were the best resource and that their involvement was crucial to the redesign process. Taking it to the streets. Paramedic Amanda Hearn has been in EMS for 10 years, five of those with OTAMs. When she heard of the plan to go to smaller units, Hearn was skeptical. I've always been in the big box trucks, and I'm not going to lie, we didn't wear our seatbelts much, she says. At a prior service, we worked out of a van-style ambulance, and I was not a fan. I feel like I couldn't do patient care, and I had limited access to my equipment. Hearn's opinions were echoed by OTAM's supervisor, Shelby Wayman. I remember the first day I heard about this. It was a hard no for me. Absolutely not interested in this design, says Wayman. But Deal and Sesgorn followed through with their promise to involve the staff in the redesign process. Wayman says this made her feel valued. Ryan constantly involved us. Options, decisions, as many crew members as we could, she says. Even if our ideas were not taken to the final draft, they were still considered and modified and used. Upon stepping foot in the unit, she found it far more spacious than she'd anticipated. It was clear the ambulance was designed for the provider to work efficiently within the unit, rather than the provider being an afterthought, Wayman says. Assessing, treating, on scene. Changing the way providers interact with patients inside the unit also meant changes to the management of the entire call. Part of the culture change at OTAMS came in the form of re-examining patient needs in terms of the speed and cadence of the encounter. OTAMS providers began rethinking what assessments, treatments, and interventions could be done on scene, not because there wasn't room in the new units, but because it was ultimately safer for the provider and patient. Hearn says she now finds herself completing much of her care on scene, especially if the patient is stable, which is most of her calls. We've run emergent traumas, don't get me wrong, she says, but I can now start an IV during transport while staying belted. We utilize our space and time more efficiently. A smaller patient compartment does require a bit more attention to the choreography of loading a patient, hooking up equipment, and making a plan for continued care. The moves are more efficient, to be sure. Sesgorn says his experience in the small space in the backs of helicopters has been invaluable. It helps to have a background in flight medicine, he says. Another change has come in debunking the pervasive myth that to provide effective care, providers must be able to stand up, move around, perform CPR en route, access equipment, etc. Even a news anchor reporting on the 2010 OTAMS crash perpetuated the idea, suggesting the reason Barron wasn't belted was because the paramedic in the back has to be free to move to treat the patient. Sesgorn was thankful for that news clip. I focused on this the most, not only with our crews, but when presenting to the board, he says. We needed to correct that inaccuracy. Naysayers emerged within the OTAMS organization. When Deal began getting asked, how are we going to transport multiple patients on backboards, he decided to examine the data in order to prove necessity. I wanted to see how often we did this in the past, and it turned out only about 3 times per year, Deal says. It was hard to justify designing an ambulance around such an infrequent event. The reliance on hard data approach proved helpful when rebutting future devil's advocates, as Sesgorn spent a good deal of time on Facebook carefully and thoughtfully answering critics of the smaller units. He even provided a video response to one critic who said the unit wasn't big enough for tall paramedics. Sesgorn found the tallest paramedic he knows, who is 6 feet 10 inches tall. That medic's reaction to sitting in the attendant seat? I feel good. I can do everything. I can reach everything. Most important, Diehl and Setzkorn wanted to give providers a sense of responsibility for their own safety. They treated the crews as teams, expecting them to perform together safely and look out for each other. Setzkorn emphasized to the EMTs who often drive that they have full control of the ambulance. He told them they'd be in trouble if it was found that their paramedic colleague wasn't wearing a seatbelt. I told them, before you put it in gear, ask your partner, are you belted? And then listen to hear the click, Setzkorn says. 6 months on, Odom's providers have overwhelming praise for the Type 2 van style. From running cardiac arrests to managing multi-system traumas, the providers haven't been hindered, and they report feeling safer and more secure. Worries about these smaller units being able to perform in a rural setting with rough roads and long miles of highway have turned out to be unfounded. Aside from a few minor design flaws, such as the screws holding the lights on the ceiling snagging a ponytail or two, and a hanging IV bag swinging too close to the patient, providers report the ride is smoother and patients even comment on its comfort and design. Patients are pleasantly surprised at the spaciousness of the compartment, and while it was not a planned benefit, patients and providers alike are enjoying the intimacy of the experience. We build a better rapport with the patient by sitting in the attendant's seat within their view, Setzkorn says. Hearn admits there's a bit of an adjustment to sitting face-to-face with the patient the whole time. In the past, during longer transports with stable patients, I might have gone to sit in the captain's chair, since it had a lap and shoulder belt, Hearn says. Now, I communicate better with my patients. Setzkorn told a recent story of a patient who saw the provider sit in front of him and said, "Oh, you're going to stay here with me? You're not going away? That's so nice." "I was blown away by that. That means the patient thought he was going to be alone," Setzkorn says. "We in healthcare know the importance of being kind to your patients. It means you care about their needs, and it gives you a little forgiveness if you make a mistake." Wayman has noticed being in constant view of her patient makes her a more observant and astute provider. "I don't rely so much on the monitor anymore. I'm talking to my patients more, observing changes in mental status, skin color, etc.," Wayman says. "Most important, I'm building a better relationship and hearing some pretty amazing stories in the process." Another unanticipated result has come in recruiting. Diehl says Odom's is getting applicants who come to interview specifically because they heard about Odom's commitment to safety. "When I'm interviewing these candidates one-on-one, I go into great detail as to why we made these changes, what our thought process was, and how we know this job is inherently dangerous," says Diehl. "I show them the new units, and they know we're offering them something that few others can, a better guarantee of safety. The responsibility is ours." While Setzkorn is no longer with the company, he's proud of what he helped establish and realizes looking back that all EMS leadership has a duty to make provider and patient safety priority number one. "The responsibility is ours," Setzkorn says. "Being complacent and allowing an outdated and dangerous practice to remain the standard can send the message that it's okay to be unbelted during transport. We shouldn't be allowing this." Ultimately, Odom's leaders remain committed to this improved culture of safety, pride and strong leadership, and a sense of personal responsibility. Just take a look at their Facebook page, which reads, in part, "When you stop making excuses as to why something can't be done and start looking for better ways to do something, anything can be accomplished. We learned early in school that a good medic learns to adapt and overcome in different situations. That's exactly what our medics are doing, adapting their approach to patient care to overcome the years of unsafe practices while providing excellent patient care. If employees are not promoting safety, then we have to look at the leadership to be sure the example and expectations are being set. A safer designed ambulance will never cure apathy and an unsafe practice. This is the quintessential example of learning from our past and seeking out a path that will lead to a better future.
This has been an episode of EMS World Podcast. You can find this article and hundreds more like it at emsworld.com. You can also follow EMS World on Twitter and Facebook. And see you in New Orleans in October for EMS World Expo.